We are on what I refer to as the long road to reform. And I have to say, we've been on it for a little while now. You see, we're doing this long setup for the Reformation because many assume that reformers like Martin Luther and John Calvin were wild aberrations, that they just sort of sprang up out of nowhere. Many Protestants assume that the Roman Catholic Church got progressively more corrupt during the late Middle Ages, and that Luther was a lone voice crying in a spiritual wilderness saying, enough. I think many Roman Catholics would agree that the late medieval church got a bit off, but they see what Luther did as a massive overreaction that took him and his supporters completely off the rails. So in this series, within the larger church story, I want to make sure that we understand that the Reformation was really the inevitable result of a long attempt at reform that had gone on for a while. And to do that, we need to go back over some of the ground we've already covered. Two episodes ago, we looked at the protests of the Englishman John Wycliffe. Wycliffe didn't so much seek to bring about reform as he did very publicly point out several ways, several places that the Roman Church had deviated from Scripture. He was able to get away with his criticisms because in England, he was both geographically and politically distant from Rome. Then, in the last episode, we considered one of my favorites of church history, the Bohemian Jan Hus. Hus was influenced by Wycliffe's work and decided to put it all into action by teaching and preaching the Bible in the common language of his time and place. It sparked a revival that saw more people attending his services than were going to the cathedral in Prague. The Roman Church couldn't abide that and decided to deal with Hus at the Council of Constance, which is the subject of this episode. But dealing with Jan Hus was really only a side issue for the council. It was called to deal with something Wycliffe, Hus, and other critics were making hay of, the papal schism. The Avignon papacies that we've covered in previous episodes engaged in numerous intrigues and conducted military forays into various regions of Europe. Those had to be funded, and so popes came up with ingenious ways to raise revenue that furthered corruption. And though some might call those tax schemes ingenious, many thought a better word would be insidious. When an ecclesiastical position was vacant, its income was sent directly to the Pope at Avignon. So popes' rather preferred positions went unfilled. That left a growing number of churches without bishops. When a position was filled, it was auctioned off to the highest bidder and a return to the practice of simony that the early church leaders had worked so hard to end. Now, since those ecclesiastical offices were a source of income, some managed to secure several. But seeing that they could only be in one place at a time, they served as absentee landlords in other parishes. Now, added to this simony and absenteeism, the nepotism that marked the Avignon papacy was so bad, by the end of the fiasco, there was a widespread sense of the need for reform of the church. And since it was the papacy itself that needed reform, the voices calling for it increasingly understood that reform, it would need to come from someone other than the Pope. The crisis that made it clear something had to be done was the great papal schism that we've already looked at in earlier episodes. We've already given a decent summary of it in previous episodes. Any more, I think, would devolve into just a long list of names that become a jumble. So let me just say that the intrigues that went on during this time are elaborate and complex and would make a great TV miniseries. Let me just summarize with this. The trouble started when the papacy returned to Rome from its 70 years in the French city of Avignon. The Roman people, understandably miffed about having been papal-less for so long, understandably demanded an Italian pope. Most of them had been French up to that point. So they got Urban VI, who turned out to be so unpleasant, the cardinals who selected him declared a do-over and elected a new pope. But Urban refused to step down. Things escalated when the Council of Pisa, in a move that could only be described as spectacularly missing the point, decided that the solution to having two popes was to elect a third. The Holy Roman Emperor Sigismund of Hungary, apparently unable to learn from history, decided that he would solve the papal traffic jam through the time-honored tradition of calling a really big meeting. So the Council of Constance was to be the mother of all church councils, a sort of medieval United Nations General Assembly. Sigismund's invitation list was ambitious. He summoned not just cardinals and bishops, but also representatives from universities, nobility, and essentially anyone who could contribute to what was shaping up to be the most expensive conference call in history. The city of Constance, a charming lakeside town that probably thought it was signing up to host a nice, quiet religious gathering, suddenly found itself dealing with an estimated 50,000 visitors, roughly equivalent to hosting the Olympics, the World Cup, and Comic-Con all at the same time. Sigismund called the council because he was persuaded to by a growing number of councillors that something had to be done in response to the obviously broken condition of the church. These councillors comprised what's called the conciliar movement. Church leaders realized the history of the church had been dramatically shaped by past councils. Those councils had kept the church on the rails when it was being threatened with derailing. Councils began all the way back in the 4th century when Constantine called the first all-church meeting at Nicaea. Other crises were solved by similar councils over the centuries. And then, when popes gained power, councils became instruments to enforce their power. This was especially true in the famous Fourth Lateran Council, which adopted a long list of policies of Pope Innocent III. But as papal authority diminished during the papal schism, many hoped that a new council would undo the wrongs that had settled in as the status quo in both church and state. As the conciliar movement grew, advocates said that such a council held more authority than the Pope because it would represent the whole church and not the partisan interests of a single person. Therefore, the council could select a new Pope that all could and should agree on. Now, it seems eminently reasonable to us in the 21st century. But the issue was tied up in a sticking point that its advocates had a hard time resolving. And that was this: who had the authority to call such a council? The first council had been called by Constantine, an emperor. Subsequent councils were convened by, well, a notable church leader who convinced other church leaders that a council was needed. Eventually, councils were convened by popes. And the findings of a council, well, they had to be officially endorsed by the pope or they were considered invalid. Well, the problem was solved in 1409 when cardinals of both sides of the papal schism agreed to a great council in Pisa. And they all lived happily ever after. Well, of course, that's not how the story goes, as you well know. On the contrary, each of the rival popes called his own council to preempt the one at Pisa. Now, you have to wonder who would consent to such silliness and be on one of those councils. Wouldn't you get an invitation and say, oh, thanks, I'm so honored, but I'm busy that month? Well, it seems that was what some said, because both papal councils failed. And they failed miserably. The rival popes retreated to strongholds to await the outcome of the Pisan Council. It had the support of both colleges of cardinals, the one in Rome and the one in Avignon, as well as most of the courts of Europe. Rather than saying one of the two papal claimants was right, the council declared both unworthy and deposed them. The council then renewed opposition to simony and several other ecclesiastical ills and elected Pope Alexander V as the new pope. Convinced that they'd ended the schism, the council adjourned. Now, you ready for some more fun? Here we go. All of this illustrates just how badly the church needed reformation. Though the Pisan Council deposed the rival popes and installed Alexander, the previous popes refused to step down and had enough support to retain their positions, in their titles at least. So now there were three popes. And then months after being elected, Alexander died, and the cardinals appointed John XXIII. The ensuing turmoil saw John flee to the German Emperor Sigismund, who was himself in a tussle with two rival claimants to his throne, each of which supported a different pope. Sigismund called another council to put an end to the now three-way papal schism. John assumed the new council would endorse his papacy and agreed with Sigismund to call it in 1414 a Constance. The council realized that John was not the reformer that they needed, and they deposed him. He fled, but was captured and returned to Constance, where he agreed to resign. Worried that he'd flee again and set up somewhere else, he was consigned to prison for the rest of his life. Then the Roman Pope, Gregory XII, resigned, as he'd promised if his rivals did likewise. The Constance Council passed some rules for reform and began the process of picking a new pope, which resulted in the selection of Martin V. Now, Benedict XIII, the last of the Avignon popes, took refuge on the coast of Spain, where he continued his claim as pope, but by now no one was listening to him. When he died in 1423, no successor was elected. So the main task of ending the papal schism complete, the Council of Constance turned its attention to the problems of simony and absenteeism. But they were unable to do anything substantive about them since so many of the church's hierarchy had either attained their position through simony or they'd grown rich through absenteeism. So the council issued some decrees and made provisions for future councils that would meet regionally to address local issues. They then turned to deal with our friend Jan Hus. Now, among those that Sigismund invited to the council was Jan Hus, the Bohemian priest whose ideas about church reform were causing considerable anxiety among the ecclesiastical establishment. Hus had been preaching radical concepts like conducting church services in languages that people could actually understand, and suggesting that perhaps the clergy shouldn't live in quite such spectacular luxury while their parishioners were subsisting on turnips and hope. Emperor Sigismund, in a move that would later be filed under decisions that seemed like a good idea at the time, granted Hus safe passage to attend the council. This was medieval Europe's equivalent of a diplomatic immunity, and theoretically meant that Hus could attend, present his case, return home safely, regardless of how much his ideas annoyed people. Unfortunately, the council fathers had apparently skipped the section in their theological training that covered the sanctity of imperial safe passage. They promptly arrested Hus, subjected him to what can only vaguely be called a trial, and when he refused to recant his teachings, they burned him at the stake. The next council, called by Pope Martin as agreed at Constance, gathered at Pavia in 1423, but then moved to Siena due to the plague. Attendance was thin, and not much was done. As 1430 and the next council drew near, Pope Martin was inclined to skip it, but advisors informed him the call for conciliarism was still strong, and if he failed to convene a council, it might provoke a new crisis. The council met in Basel, during which Martin died. The council picked Eugene IV as his successor, and as soon as he was elected, Eugene adjourned the council. But they refused to quit and considered deposing him. Under threat by Emperor Sigismund, Eugene withdrew the decree of adjournment. Up to this point, the Basel Council had gone virtually unnoticed by Europe, but now all eyes were on it. A council seemed to have gained power over a pope. Some said that the council ought to stay convened and rule the church directly. It was then that an urgent request for help came from Constantinople, being severely threatened by the Turks at the time. Both the Byzantine Emperor and the Patriarch said that they were willing to rejoin the Western Church and take part in the council if it would move to a city closer to Constantinople. Eugene saw this as a way to regain some of his mojo and move the council to Ferrara in northeast Italy. Most of the council refused to relocate, but some, in hopes of ending the long rift between the East and the West, they went to Ferrara. And so it was that the conciliar movement, which had come into being as a response to the schism, was itself schizzed. Yeah, I know that's not a word. There were now two councils. Oh, and one pope. The Council of Ferrara later moved to Florence, where it gained recognition for seeing the Eastern Church accept papal authority. The Council of Basel, meanwhile, became more radical in its pronouncements, causing increasing numbers of its members to leave and head off to Ferrara. Basel deposed Pope Eugene and named Felix V as the new pope. So are you keeping track? There are now two councils and two popes. The conciliar movement, conceived as a way to end the schism, ended up resurrecting it. But the truth is, the council in Basel had dwindled down to such a small number that people paid little attention to it. They moved to Lausanne and eventually disbanded when they realized that they were irrelevant. Felix V gave up his claim to the papacy. Well, it seemed for a while that conciliarism would be a standing feature of church life. In the end, the popes won. Any future councils will be only at their discretion.